you ever seen a movie or book that the characters to you were so compelling that you almost felt like they were real people? Like when something bad happened to them, you legitimately felt pain for them, or
all the time,
or seething hatred.
David Bowie's
or
character
like
in
that.
The Labyrinth.
Yeah. On Netflix right now, I've been watching Rectify. I don't know if you guys have
seen that. No.
It's like Orange is the New Black meets True Detective with none of the fun.
Oh!
This guy gets back from gets out of prison. He's not really exonerated, but his murder charges are dismissed because DNA evidence shows there's none.
Okay.
And he's turned out to be a very thoughtful individual while in prison. He's relied on meditation and reading the classics to help him survive in there. So you meet this character, Daniel, as this very thoughtful person as he's exploring the world again outside of isolation.
Oh,
he's been in the hole his entire 20 years in there or whatever it is.
It already sounds depressing. Like
It's amazing. It's so slow paced. Like a lot of the scenes are just the character sitting in his bedroom watching dust float around in a sunbeam. But those are the types of things to him that are huge sensory experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard not to form a close bond with the character. So it's the second – at the end of the second season, they kind of set it up where it's looking very likely that they're going to send him right back to prison. And my wife and I talked about it. We're like, we're not going to watch season three. We care too much about this Daniel character.
That's breaking my heart.
We can't watch this show because we're so attached to the guy. Like I think about this in the morning
just
when I get up.
Just make up your own
ending.
And he lived happily ever after.
Because I'm pretty sure this show is so realistic that I'm pretty sure it won't end well.
Well, yeah, recidivism rates being what they are, it seems likely.
I feel like, Jeremy, you should have a my favorite show segment on this show.
Next week, BoJack Horseman.
Well, that's all I had for God Things Like You today.
So hope that got you thinking.
All right. Yeah. Well, this segment brought to you by Netflix.
Believe it or not, in the 17th and 18th centuries, philosophers were very curious about this phenomena. The Enlightenment philosophers tended to be empiricists, and they were very curious about how art in particular can sometimes generate factual judgments for us or very strong emotional feelings, even though they are complete works of imagination or fiction.
Having real experiences derived from fake things.
They felt that if we could unravel the mysteries of how this happened, we might have a better idea of what our psychological faculties are really grounded in.
Mm-hmm.
And so this experience I'm relating that I think we've all had is sometimes called the paradox of fiction. Premise one, to fear for someone, we must believe they are actually in danger. Somebody can't say pretend your wife is going to get in a car accident and me get all that concerned and start dialing. I need to think that it's real. Premise two, we do not believe the dangers described in fictions are real. Of course not. Premise three, but we fear for characters in fictions who are in danger. Or we could substitute any other emotional thing into those premises. But the idea is all three of those premises appear to be true, but the conjunction of all three cannot possibly be true. Mm-hmm. It's a paradox. How does this happen? It's deeper than just the emotions we feel for characters. It's the fact that almost all of our normal cognitive inferences we bring to everyday life get rolled into this.
Do you think this accounts for the popularity of so-called reality TV? There's nothing really real about so-called reality show, but you have that less distance of fiction. You can pretend, they're playing themselves, essentially.
Yeah.
I feel more investment. I feel more fear, more happiness.
Yeah,
I wonder.
There's absolutely nothing contrived in, in Survivor.
And it's weird because I feel less for people on those shows I do for like on Breaking Bad.
I tend to hate those individuals.
Well, people have tried to say this. This also supplies some evidence for why realism is so compelling in literature and why fantasy is more compelling if it's the kind that, Rushdie or Borges writes, where it's where the fantasy is integrated into that world
like
as if it were real. Yeah. I think there might be something to say for that. Typically, in cognitive science and in aesthetics, the way to answer this has been to show that our brain pretty much uses the same systems for imagination that it does for reality. Hmm. A lot of the things I'll be quoting here come from the Oxford Handbook of Aesthetics.
So grab your copies at home, folks.
Yeah.
Follow along. Page 72.
I'm sorry, I can't provide better citations than that at the moment. But PET scans have revealed that the brain reuses the exact same visual systems when it's constructing imaginative mental imagery. Mm. To a PET scan, seeing something and imagining it doesn't look all that different.
So like a Humean gold mountain – where you take the concepts that you do experience in real life and you place them together to form a fictional idea.
Was that Hume or Locke?
Pretty sure that was Hume.
Okay.
Unless he was – I don't know.
I don't think it matters though. exactly like that. To make it even more weird, you can take subjects in a lab and show them black and white horizontal line, you know, several in a row, and ask them to walk back. How many paces back does it take before those lines start to blur and you can't see the – partitions. Yeah. Let's just say it's 30 paces. Well, when you take a subject and imaginatively ask them, close your eyes and imagine you're looking at this now and you're walking backwards, just count how many paces before you can't see it, they say the same result.
Wow.
And even stranger than that, certain visual phenomena that most people don't know about and could in no way predict have the same result. You take those horizontal lines, you make them diagonal all of a sudden. Your visual system is better at differentiating that. So it's going to take 5 or 10 more paces before you can't see it. Hmm. And imaginatively, the exact same thing happens again. In other words, you seem to be simulating your imaginary scenarios based on the exact same physics and intuitions that you do in the rest of the system. And they found some really cool interactions with fictional narratives that go along this line. For example, let's say you're reading a story and you read this sentence. Bill was in the living room reading the evening paper. Then you give one half of your subjects the following sentence. Before Bill had finished the paper, John came into the room. Then you give the other subjects this sentence. Before Bill had finished the paper, John went into the room instead of came into the room. Subjects actually take longer to read sentence B. If you measure their process time, it takes a little extra time for them to get through that. Why would that require extra processing? Well, when you start asking other questions of a similar sort, it comes out that even when you're not trying to form images of what you're reading, your brain is creating a model of that environment. Mm-hmm. When John comes into the room, you're already situated
in the room, and
in the
he's
room
coming
with Bill.
Into it.
Yeah.
Whereas if he went into the room, we're establishing that he's somewhere else.
Exactly. You've got to create a new –
and that's that's even when the subjects say, I haven't been visualizing this. This is just me reading. They do this with other items, like how quickly can you recall the various different items that were in the room that were mentioned, and they all follow the same processing rule. I really like that finding too because – you know, some of these philosophers said, well, maybe we care about fiction because we imagine we're in the fiction. That seemed like such a simplistic way to think about it and doesn't conform with personal experience that often. But indeed, that seems to be what happens. And we make all sorts of other inferences too. Your mind doesn't take very long to process that the character wakes up in Chicago and goes to bed in, say, Hong Kong. We just know, we make the inference, he must have taken a plane. But if we're in a different historical era and the same thing happens, people do note it. Their brain takes more time to process it. They seem more puzzled, meaning they're importing all their ordinary inferences. Mm-hmm. So the idea, I guess, of cognitive science and aesthetic philosophy, how to resolve this paradox of fiction, is that we're very robustly simulating worlds in our minds. And there's just at least one final stage between a factual belief and something we've imagined that is different. That is, we give our allegiance to the factual belief. We know in the end that these things aren't real, with imaginations, of course, and then with real events we think they are. There's just that somehow that truth status, I guess you could say, of the belief is different.
So wait, Jeremy, when do you get the part where you just say that God is like a make-believe fairy tale?
Yeah.
When's that part coming
up? Well, that's That's kind of coming next. So maybe you've seen the study that's been going around. It was on NPR last week, and I'm starting to see it on atheist blogs. We had somebody post it on our Facebook page. Religious beliefs are not factual beliefs is the name of the title. And you can imagine how people on our side would love a headline like that, right?
Someone messaged me about that and asked me about it, and because I hadn't read it, and it seemed pretty – like, it seemed too good to be true. I'm like, I'm not going to comment on that.
Yeah.
Because it's almost certain that it's really oversimplified. Or
the author of the study actually was inspired by that paradox of fiction.
Okay.
And his basic idea is psychology and epistemology have been treating belief as if it's a single thing. And he is proposing actually that religious beliefs, they are a completely different, separate and distinct cognitive attitude than the ones we use when forming factual beliefs. And he thinks they're more similar to things like imagining or hypothesis formation, mm-hmm. or accepting something for the sake of debate. Religious beliefs are using more of those cognitive mechanisms than the ones we use for everyday factual processing. He makes his case this way. Factual beliefs have these three characteristics that imaginings or religious credence, as he calls it, do not. One, they are practical setting independent. It really doesn't matter what the setting is. Your factual beliefs will always be operating in the background. Two, that they cognitively govern other attitudes. So they kind of have a privileged status in the brain. And that three, they are evidentially vulnerable. You give somebody counter evidence, you quite quickly extinguish the old belief. And that can even be a rather automatic thing.
Sure.
He feels that religious beliefs do not have any of these three characteristics. And in fact, religious beliefs on top of that have a whole other suite of characteristics that aren't true of factual beliefs.
So is he saying that this is a this tends to be the case, that they tend to not be like that? Or is he saying just as a matter of principle, religious beliefs are fundamentally different?
You'd have to read the paper and form your own judgment. But while he does occasionally admit some gray area here,
mm-hmm.
he at the same time in his formulation of his theory presents it as pretty cut and dry.
Okay.
Though he'll admit occasionally there are areas where there's a tiny bit of overlap. But he feels that overlap is not really a threat to his theory because they are rare, exceptional circumstances.
Hmm.
Now, here's the thing. I think after having read through this thing in way more detail than I cared to,
this is what you always do.
Yeah, I feel there's some element of truth in what he's saying here. It's just to me, it's one of those cases where your evidence doesn't quite suggest your theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory itself is so – it's supposed to be so sweeping and so revolutionary that I'm afraid people will – in our camp might take it more seriously than they should.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to share his point of view, hopefully as open-minded as I can, while also injecting some skepticism into it. Starting with the basics, the idea that factual beliefs are practical, setting independent. He has a kind of cute example to illustrate this. Have a kid playing like they're at a pretend tea party, right? There are actually studies like this where they're making little Play-Doh cookies and stuff and pretending to eat the cookies and all that. The experimenter suddenly eats one of the Play-Doh cookies.
It's non-toxic. It's fine.
Yeah, you'll live.
Okay, yeah.
You'll live. You'll crap all sorts of crazy colors, but
totally worth it.
Yeah.
It's half the fun.
You should try. Can you squeeze out little star shapes and stuff?
Oh, depending
depending on the shape of your rectum. We did it again.
Of course, the children know what's going on. The factual beliefs have always been going on underneath this play context, right? They're not context dependent. So in order to do the play, they have to actually utilize all of their factual sets of beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just their playtime scenarios, like they'll ask the kid, oh, we spilled some of that tea. Where do they mop up the invisible pretend tea? Well, they mop up below the teapot.
Where the spill
would
have been.
Exactly where their intuitive physics say the spill should be.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they leave the context of their imaginary scenario, all of that, all of those frames drop. It goes away.
I see this every day. I can vouch for this.
You see that factual beliefs are always running in the background when imaginings are context specific. Mm-hmm. You know, related to that is his second point, factual beliefs have cognitive governance. And what he means by that is if you're going to draw inference from one set of beliefs to another, you're only going to do it from factual imaginative. He gives a little thought experiment to illustrate this. Somebody tells you to imagine Michelangelo's David falls off a boat into the water.
Cowabunga!
Different Michelangelo, you get the idea.
Okay.
Damn it, Dave.
By the way, check out the epic rap battle between the Ninja Turtles and the Renaissance painters. Yeah, it's pretty kick-ass. So you're imagining this falls off the boat. What happens next?
Your intuitive physics just goes and creates the story.
Right. Because you know you have that factual belief that that statue is made out of marble, mm-hmm. and you know that marble sinks in water. And so he says, you know, here's your inferred imagining. Now mm-hmm. you're picturing it sinking. He points out it doesn't go the other way around. You don't hear that Michelangelo's David is made out of marble and it sinks in water. Now imagine Michelangelo's David falling off the pier.
Right.
And you suddenly go, oh my gosh, it's sinking. And you call up the museum and everything else. We don't do that. And it's a good thing that our brains structure have that kind of governance with the factual stuff taking priority over the imagined. So he says, you know, the intuitions don't run the other way around. Mm-hmm. The last one, of course, factual beliefs are evidentially vulnerable. And the point is this is kind of quick and kind of automatic. Okay, you think your cat's outside, but then you hear it meowing in, you know, the next room.
Right.
You make the conclusion and you extinguish immediately that false belief. It doesn't persist.
You're not like, how is the cat here? Yeah. He's outside.
Oh, my God. Was that acid I just
Schrodinger's cat.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there you go.
He's outside and inside.
Yeah.
So I think those are all very useful categories.
Yeah. Then here's his case that religious beliefs are not like that.
Sure.
Which is the part where I'm a little more critical.
I mean, off the cuff, the third category seems to be the case with probably the vast majority of religious belief. Just because I think that religious belief is held for non-evidentiary reasons for the most part. But that is, of course, not the case with everybody.
Which one of us wouldn't say that religious reasoning seems to be pretty immune to evidence?
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. Right. But I would say that I do think there are some religious believers that do are at least sensitive to it.
To say that this is rule governed by a cognitive process in the mind, I think, is a stronger claim than just, you know, wow, there's a lot of dissonance that they can handle in order to maintain their belief.
Yeah.
Religious credence is practical setting dependent. This is where it starts bothering me. He doesn't use a lot of evidence. And when he does use evidence, it tends to be like really exotic stuff from anthropologists in the third world studying pre-literate cultures, which – those studies tend to be plagued by language barriers, lack of cultural understanding.
Yeah.
And so he talks about this study as Tutsi and Harris in 2008 with the Vizo people. I think we've mentioned this on the show before. Anthropologists noticed that when they asked questions about a dead ancestor in a ceremonial setting, such as like during a burial or something, mm-hmm. asking them questions, can the deceased ancestor see? Can they think? Do they feel emotions right now? In the ritual context, the people would affirm all those things were true. But when they started in a more naturalistic setting, when they started asking questions about the corpse, can it see, can it think, everybody was like, of course not, and started treating it naturalistically. And so he's saying this is clearly the case that the religiosity is turned off once it's outside of its ritual context.
Yeah.
And now people are thinking just their fact-based modes of thinking, which says the body is dead.
Yeah.
Buy that because, I mean, you're talking about the body as opposed to in that same context, if you had said, do you believe their spirit is watching
exactly,
you?
Exactly, yeah.
They would still answer in the affirmative, I suspect.
Yeah, that's what I'm suspecting
exactly.
too.
Yeah.
Whereas he's treating it as like it just goes offline. Look, if you believe the spirit is distanced from the body after death, there's no contradiction implied by holding those two attitudes.
The body's just the thing and not the –
So if we're going to make a huge claim, I want to see better evidence than that. He does use a few more examples, but they're all of that kind, mm-hmm. that you could imagine a different way to explain the data. But he's saying here, it's silly to see this as simple belief. I'm in a religious ritual so the ancestor can see me, and then I have a simple belief. I'm in a naturalistic setting, so the ancestor is a lifeless corpse. What's easier to see this is as a religious credence from one system overlapping a factual belief from the other. I'm still not sure that's the case.
I would be fascinated if you could ask this question of the ancient Egyptians who believed that the body was an essential part of the afterlife as well, hence the mummification. Would they answer differently because they prepare the body so that the spirit can keep using the body?
Yeah, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. Yeah.
Fortunately, they're not around, so it makes it tough.
It's even less plausible to me when he brings this into the realm of, say, a professor who's a creationist but a geologist at the same time. Mm-hmm. He wants us to think the same thing. He wants us to think that they're not just compartmentalizing or publishing what they know will get published, you know, which is what, in fact, a lot of these people do. They flat out say, hey, look, the paradigms of science ask for one thing, and so I do my research in that paradigm, but I happen to believe something else. Mm. He seems to think of it as a matter where they just kind of switch off their religious belief in the laboratory setting and start thinking factually. And I find that kind of preposterous.
It's a very seductive way to think about it, mm-hmm. that, you know, oh – yes, they're just switching it on and off, but I don't think it actually is that cut and dry.
He also says religious credence lacks this general cognitive governance that we talked about before. The inferences don't go – they only go one way, from factual to imaginary. Mm-hmm. He talks about a study where a series of little stories as about how God helped different people was given. And even though by a large margin all the subjects thought of God as being – omnipresent, everywhere at once, not a single one of the subjects, when they were asked to reconstruct the timeline of events and sequence it, none of them said that all these healings could be happening simultaneously. They had to construct a – this was actually from Barrett, who we've talked about on the show before, that they had to reconstruct a scenario in a timeline fashion. Mm-hmm. There's not these simultaneous things going on. But still, the task required them to imagine. And so if we're already using our inference systems for imagining, right, wouldn't that be the imagery that pops into your head? You know, we don't imagine square circles or other things too. So the same being in two places at once, I wouldn't expect anybody to imagine that. Right. Does that mean that they are using an entirely different cognitive system or that none of their religious imaginings of the world ever bleed into their factual thoughts about the world? I don't find that very likely.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly that's just false because there are religious beliefs such as moral beliefs that do affect the way people vote and affect the way people treat other people. Mm-hmm. Is that not obvious?
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe am I strong?
I think since he's usually talking about factual beliefs, he usually has facts more in the mundane sphere of things, like what's in my cupboard. You know,
the Holy Spirit.
You know, which cities are north of Chicago versus south. I think he would he would want us to see that kind of level. But yeah, I don't know. I could think of all sorts of. We've talked about just world belief on the show. That was one of the things that popped into my head.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where somebody rather unconsciously and directly forms a factual opinion about the guilt or innocence of a person.
Because of a
weird metaphysical view that is one of their religious credences, he would say.
And we also talked about people with divine command theory, how they that's not just an abstract moral theory. It does come down to how they judge moral situations in a very severely deontological.
Right. All of Luke's research on these charitable games has people changing their inference about the morality of the person or the T-shirt study.
Oh, right.
Nobody was even given a factual belief that I was an atheist versus a Christian. But by subtle cues, The people who had the most pronounced bias were those who had religious viewpoints, right, which strongly suggests that their perception of factual matters
does bleed into the real world.
Yeah, was being fed in initially by imaginative ones. I find it funny that he surveys so much research but doesn't ever mention these. Hmm. Final one, religious credences lack evidential vulnerability. This one, again, really bad example, I thought. He compared the Y2K paranoia at the change of the millennium. Can we even remember this? But yeah, people were freaked out that all the computers were going to shut down.
I was super freaked out.
Were you?
I demanded my mom and dad take all their money out of the bank. I remember saying that.
My dad was forming plans to build a power to put a propane tank under our property so that we could have continuous power during that time. And I managed – even then I was skeptical of that and managed to disabuse him of that strategy.
I remember when what the first – I guess somewhere in Russia or something.
I was super worried when it clicked over midnight.
12 a.m. and nothing happened. I was like, well, if they got this handled in Siberia, we're probably okay.
So, yeah.
But, yeah.
He compares that as, you know, a typical case where as soon as the events came about, people amended. There was no problem, right?
Exactly.
And he compares that to failed end times prophecies, right?
Which is a natural comparison.
Yeah. But actually, I don't think it's all that good, because his idea, what he's taking away from, is the religious ones were immune to falsification because they were imaginings, and we weren't thinking about them as fact. He noted that their conviction in the prophecy became stronger. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the particulars of each scenario, it's not really breaking down like that. Many of the people who accepted the prophecies did significant revisions to get them in line with the facts.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had to reinterpret.
Too many people were like, yep, the end came. I don't know why we feel like we're still here talking to each other, but the world has come to an end. It was all stuff like, well, it was more of a spiritual thing, or we prayed enough that we prevented this from happening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the Y2K thing, that was true too. Not a lot of people who were obsessed Y2K fanatics just went, well, there was never a problem to begin with. We were wrong. They said, well, because of us raising alarm and all of those people going in to fix the code. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think – if this is true, he's got to find better evidence for it. I mean, he has some good things to say, like – look at how people on the autism spectrum do not accept religious beliefs because they tend to be much more fact-based in all of their analyses. I think that's a good point. I just don't feel it's enough. Right. And so I'll pay just a quick lip service to all of the things that he says are special properties of religious credence that aren't true of factual beliefs either, because I don't think there's a single thing in this list that works. First of all, he says the normative orientation of religious beliefs, that they have, you know, they are seen as having strong moral components. And he uses all of those religious priming studies, how religious priming makes people less likely to cheat and, more likely to share and be generous with others. Look how those are not like ordinary facts of the world. They immediately force us into moral thinking. Well, as Luke's pointed out, so does reading a part of the Constitution or talking about how, you know, there's people watching you.
Yeah.
Those are factual beliefs that have the exact same priming effects.
Or even pictures of eyes on the wall.
So factual beliefs can have normative orientation, just as religious beliefs sometimes have none at all. We talked about, again, just a couple episodes ago, if you had an anthropomorphic god, you viewed violations of that God's rules as serious moral problems. Whereas if you took a more theological concept, violations might just be breaking doctrinal barriers, not always really moral things. So he's got his stuff all mixed up on that. When he talks about religious beliefs come with free elaboration, I have to mention this just because I hated the example. But his –
we're getting a bean beat down today.
Who would deny that religious individuals do tend to tell a lot of stories about their gods, right, and tend to make up details? But his idea is that this free elaboration, they generate ontological posits that are not rationally entailed by the evidence or previous credences at all.
What?
And I think most of the time when religious people elaborate on their gods, it's for a particular reason. He uses as his sole piece of evidence, his sole piece of evidence is Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God by Jonathan Edwards.
Really, he says, up with the modern theology.
Yeah.
Huh?
Edwards says, he says, there are now objects of that very same anger and wrath that God has expressed in the torments of hell. Yea, God is a great deal more angry with great numbers that are here now on earth. Yea, doubtless with many that are in this congregation that may be at ease or quiet than he is with the many of those that are now in the flames of hell. And he just says, okay, so that God is more angry with the parishioners than people who are already in hell? That's just made up out of nowhere. But a religious person can do that.
Oh.
It's not. Edwards accepts a very Pauline theology.
I was going to say, this is coming right from the Bible.
Yeah, where they flat out tell you, look, God hates you people who have been given the truth. Yeah. And still go on sinning.
Those
a
lukewarm
lot more.
People, he will spit out of his mouth. He would rather have hot or cold, right?
The last one he says is vulnerability to special authority. For some reason, religious propositions are special because we care more about the moral authority of the person rather than their factual authority or something to that. He does this comparison. Imagine a scenario where a church pastor who is a special authority can be fired for an extramarital affair, but it's unlikely that an expert computer systems consultant would be. Well, yeah.
Because also, IT guys can't get laid. Is that the point?
The preacher's job is to instill that moral code.
Right.
It's a hypocrisy thing. Mm. If somebody else was part of a nonprofit organization for monogamy or something like that and was found having a bunch of affairs, I'm pretty sure they would be fired too.
Right.
I don't see how this is any special.
But not necessarily if the janitor were doing it. You know, it's got to be someone whose role dictates a certain way to behave.
So I think there's an interesting idea that he has about there perhaps being two very different cognitive processes here that are layered over each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we ought to tease out belief more carefully. But to spell it out as in concrete a system as he's done, I just don't think it follows.
Yeah.
What's a shame to me is there's a much more interesting article in the exact same journal, Cognition, in the exact same month that deals with these themes. It was also inspired by the paradox of fiction, and it gives some really, I think, interesting results that are much more grounded in empirical data that I don't think is going to get as much attention from people like us because it doesn't have as provocative of a headline. The article is Daniela Shidlovsky from Hebrew University. This is her PhD thesis, actually. The title of this article is If I Imagine It, Then It Happened. The Implicit Truth Value of Imaginary Representations. She differentiates between explicit truth value, so our ordinary means of judging something rationally using our background information to assess the credibility of a claim.
Mm-hmm.
And then implicit truth value, she says, is one of those other systems, you know, the kind of spontaneous, automatic, unconscious gauging of truth. The basic idea, and this has been borne out by other experiments, when uncertainty exists regarding the explicit truth value of an event or a fact or something, we tend to rely on cues that are outside of the content of the belief in question, such as how vivid an image can we form of it?
Hmm.
What perspective is it coming from? Is it from a first-person perspective or a third? That these all influence our judgments of truth when we have nothing better to rely on. That's been pretty well established by other research. Her question was, can non-content cues, in this case imagination, influence your truth evaluation even when you know the proposition is false? And so what they did is – it was a rather ingenious setup, I thought. To measure this intrinsic truth value of a belief, what they did was an autobiographical implicit association test. So this is basically just getting you to tell different stories – and maybe things that were true of you and things that were false. And they look at your response time to different cues. We've seen this before, for example, with some of these racism, implicit racism tests. years ago. We talked about Alan Alda, who I don't think of as a particularly racist guy.
No, you know? He's a good open-minded feminist
Yeah,
guy.
He's a hardcore activist. Oh, that's what it was. It was feminism.
Yeah.
And he took the implicit association test basically by looking at his reaction times to a bunch of questions. They could tell that implicitly he still had some sexist biases underneath.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We would say his explicit truth value of sexist propositions would be that they're false.
Right.
But implicitly we can tell that his brain is having a harder time disentangling the truth from these sexist stereotypes.
So like kind of dispositional.
You know, some think maybe this is just tracking like we're aware of cultural stereotypes.
Right.
This research suggests it might be a little bit deeper down, but they used the same basic approach. They used a similar test of reaction time to gauge what somebody's implicit truth value of a situation was. Then they had them do two basic experiments. I'm going to be cutting out a lot of detail here because I don't think it's relevant, but I was very impressed with how well controlled this was and how well they thought of other interpretations and tried to control for them. Imagine pulling the seven of clubs from a deck of cards, or they are given a circle to color. Do they color it blue or do they color it red? Anyways, when they matched up, when they actually did the experiments, the people who were told, instructed to vividly imagine coloring in the circle,
mm-hmm.
or to vividly imagine pulling the card, slightly less than half of the respondents accidentally did misidentify their imaginings as real memories. So
Whoa.
right there, it's just vividly imagining something does seem to make it pretty true to your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting is even of the group that said no, explicitly this never happened, this implicitly they had that same confusion, that slower reaction time, as if even though rationally they knew this had never happened, but that implicit truth value underlying it had a hard time accepting that.
Hmm.
So their mind was still operating somewhere deep down on a level that thought it could kind of be true. Or they had a harder time overcoming the idea that it wasn't true. This was across the board for the people who knew that these were just memories. And what was even more interesting is you could kind of – you could modify that. You could do things that would not modify your explicit truth value of any statement. That would remain the same, but would make your implicit truth value increase to a significant degree. And one of those things was imagine it from a first-person perspective – or imagine this, somebody else is coloring in the square. The conclusion was we often are deceived by our imaginations into mistaking these things as real. But even when we aren't, that activity still goes on. So you can imagine, especially in contexts where we can't go out and verify the explicit truth value through ordinary means, what do you think is going to call the shots cognitively? The vividness of our imaginations.
Mm.
Let's think of all the things we've discussed on the show. Our interview with Tanya Lerman, where the charismatic believers that she was embedded with actively practiced every day. In fact, they found that a remedy to lack of faith, constantly imagine that they're talking to God, mm-hmm. that they're sitting across from God and having a cup of coffee. Oh, pour a cup of coffee for him. Let him have a seat at the table. How hard is it then for these people, even when they're given factual evidence to the contrary, to disabuse themselves of what they have so ingrained through their imaginative capacity? I don't know. I personally thought that was a way more compelling
Sounds
article
really
and got really to the heart of the matter.